AM 640. You have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show, a very special three-hour episode of the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. If you're new to my show, I have a PhD in clinical psychology, and I specialize in the science of love. How are the biological piece, the psychological piece, and the social piece? You can follow me anywhere on my social media where I answer questions all day long, but the most important place to get live answers is right here on KFI. We are here for 3 hours. Sit back. I am going to fix your lives. Trust me. You know, the most important decision that anyone can make in their lifespan is their choice of romantic partner. It will dictate where you live, who you hang with, how much money you make, what your health is going to be like, if you're obese or not, whether if you're a woman and you choose poorly, whether you're a victim of domestic violence or, God forbid, murder. It is a huge, crucial decision. And we're going to talk about it. Before we get going, though, I want to make sure my team's in place. We got David over there on board.
How you doing, Dr. Wendy?
Nice to see you. It's hot outside, isn't it, David? Have you been inside this air conditioning all day?
I've been in here since about 2 o'clock.
Okay, I just put on a cashmere sweater, folks, but outside it's like 102. Producer Kayla, you're right here.
Hey, Dr. Wendy.
You ready to take over the phones a little later when people call in with their relationship questions?
Always.
Kind and gentle.
I always am.
Issues of the heart are tender, and this pain is real to a lot of people.
Thanks, Wendy.
And we have Mark Rahner.
Why, hello.
Nice to see you. I don't get to see you very often.
I'm all over the place as a fill-in professional, but I'm glad to be here with you. Maybe you can give me some advice.
Exactly. If anything comes to mind, you can just jump right in.
Many thanks.
All right. So if you are one of my students at California State University Channel Islands, thank you for not coming to school. If you have a sniffle, a sick tummy, anything going on, week one, it was reported that we had 11 cases on campus, despite the fact that everybody is vaccinated. And of those 11 cases, 7 had some kind of symptoms, but said, you know, I didn't want to miss the first week of class. So I tell all my, so here's the thing. Remember a few weeks ago, I was talking about how my teenager came back from Germany and had this bad stomach flu, but we didn't know what it was. And I took her to emergency at night and there were hospital beds lining the hallways and out in the parking lot under tents. I'm like, oh, this is where they keep the COVID. Oh my gosh. And I said to the doctor, don't worry. It's just a stomach thing. I'm sure it's not COVID. And he said, no, we are actually seeing a lot that are intestinal only. People think they got food poisoning and they ate something a little funky and that's what it is. Or, and a couple weeks later, when she actually did get a breakthrough infection of COVID, it presented as just a sinus infection. So don't think you might have just a light cold. Don't think that you just ate something funky. Stay home, get tested, quarantine, whatever. And if you're one of my students, you know, you're not going to miss anything. Everything's on Canvas. I'll give you an extra credit assignment if you think you're missing the attendance grade. Don't worry. We'll work with it. Consider getting a booster, folks. We're getting near that time. My book group had 3 physicians in it, and they were all saying, yeah, we've ordered boosters for all our family. So what the doctors do for their family, I'm happy to do for mine. I think that's the way to go. This week, the news is Texas Heartbeat Act. Look it. I don't want to get into a political debate. I don't even want to get into a deep medical debate. I want to get into a little social, interesting comment. So as you know, I have a very huge following on TikTok. And if you're not there, join the party. Come on over to TikTok. And I've been noticing there's a TikTok trend. And if you don't know what a TikTok trend is, it's where a certain song lyric becomes popular in the background and people kind of lip sync to it. But they're really meaning to make another comment on something else. They might have graphics in front explaining what they really mean. And this particular song, the lyric says, I understand the assignment. I understand the assignment. And women are lip-syncing to it, but the graphics in front of their face are saying things like, I have 100,000 frequent flyer points, ladies in Texas, as we need to come to California for any little appointment. We're here. Or they'll say, I have a beach house. I've got 3 extra bedrooms, and I'm great at making a post-op meal. I'm a mom. If you need to come in Texas, we're here. There is a tidal wave of women on social media offering to just take any women out of Texas. Maybe that's what Texas has become, and that's the problem, out of Texas. And then the only other comment I want to make, I love that. I love women's support, blah, blah, blah. But the other comment I make is I saw a video on social media posted by a critical care nurse, And she said, I used to be pro-life. I am now pro-choice because of this. I don't believe in the heartbeat law. And she explained that if life begins at a heartbeat, and as the law says, it ends at a stopped heartbeat, you know, her job is to actually artificially keep hearts beating in brain-dead people so that organs can be harvested to bring life to others. And her question was, how can we say life begins at a heartbeat when we don't let life end at a heartbeat? And I'm like, whoo, that kind of exploded my brain a little bit. Anyway, the good news is this. I will say this. Most of our country and most of our state here is pretty progressive. When these funky little laws come up, they usually happen because some lawmaker wants their constituents to think that they are anti-abortion so that they can get more votes. The truth is there's always some flaw in the law that ends up getting challenged and the law gets torn down. And I feel quite confident that will happen in this case too. But it doesn't mean that we should stop and do nothing. All right. Other thing is my childhood best friend is in town from Miami because she's settling her daughter into an apartment for university. And it's so great to have a historical friend here. And I thought I would take a moment to remind you that it is unfair to put pressure on all of your friends to be the same kind of friend. And once you understand that our friends fall in very different categories, then you can understand sort of what their place is in our life. So at sort of the lowest end of friendship would be what I call the tertiary friends. And those are the people that might be your barista at Starbucks and see you come in the back door and already make your little coffee. You might know their first name, or maybe it's someone you just sort of see once in a while at yoga and you wave, whatever. But, you know, they're not going to drive you to the airport. They're not going to be at the emergency room at 3 a.m. But you need them as part of your social support in your life. Then we have these friends that I call stage of life friends. They were so important to you during a particular stage of life, you will never forget them, but you've outgrown that stage. So they might be the mommy friends from baby group, your college friends, your friends when you first started your career and started working. Then, of course, we have our common interest friends, the ones we go to gardening club with or yoga or whatever. And of course, we have our deep, intimate friends. But our historical friends, the one from eighth grade who slept on my couch last night, they're the ones who know you when, who knew you when. They're the ones who remind you of who you really are. And that's why it feels so good to have this friend in town. All right, when we come back, I want to ask you this. Are you too trusting? Do you believe everything at the beginning of a relationship and then wonder why they suddenly turned like crazy or inappropriate for you? Let's talk about maybe what happened in your early childhood to make you so trusting. You are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. We're live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
KFI AM 640. You have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. I want to talk about love. You know what? Love is hard. And you know why it's hard? Is because despite what your culture tells you about Cupid and a bow, rom-coms that seem to end at the beginning of a love relationship, love is hard. And when you hear that it's work, the mental work of love is often going against kind of what you were programmed. Okay, let me explain. So early in life, often before you were verbal, when your brain tripled in size, for instance, during the first year of life, your brain formed a kind of blueprint for love, a pattern that said, oh, this is what love is. Now, if you were fortunate enough to have caregivers who took care of your needs, who were very attentive to your feelings and emotions, you grew up to trust the world, trust people, and trust love. And unconsciously, automatically, you'll go out into the world and you will choose partners that feel like your version of love, which is secure. It's peaceful. But unfortunately, that's not the majority of us. The majority of us had all kinds of stuff happen. And unconsciously, we may go out into the world and find people who will make our greatest nightmares happen because our smart little brains are trying to solve the conflict this time around. Now, I mentioned I have a pretty big following on TikTok, and a big portion of those followers are people who have an anxious attachment style, meaning that they were the baby that was left in the crib crying because the parents were told it's good for their lungs, they'll sleep better, allow them to cry it out. And they might have been left hungry or in a wet diaper. Maybe they had parenting that was really inconsistent. Maybe their parents suffered from addiction of some, and there was sort of good mommy and bad mommy, depending on if she was high or not. Or daddy that was abandoning, there or not. And so you also have to have a bit of a gene for anxiety too, right? And so you come into this world with this slight gene for anxiety, and you're left there vulnerable, cold, maybe hungry, longing. And this starts to become your idea of what love should be. Now, I want you to know that good, healthy relationships are built on a foundation of safety and trust. In healthy relationships, believe it or not, people believe that they won't ever be hurt by their partner, not physically or emotionally. So why do you feel insecure in your relationships? Well, there are a number of reasons. As I said, your past gets involved. And your past gets involved in one of three ways. Either you've been betrayed by your family growing up, so you're just hypersensitive to signs of distrust. In other words, even if your partner is kind of trustworthy, you are sniffing out all the, you know, no, where are you going? Who are you with? What's happening? And that's just it's like your fight or flight response at all times. And that will cause conflict in relationships right there. Or maybe, you've been fortunate enough to choose a really trustworthy partner, but you provoke all kinds of problems in your new relationship where no problems exist because you need to create your familiar schema of love. Yeah, we will actually create our version of love. We will poke and prod and drive that person crazy. Now, some of you, and this was probably me, back when I had an anxious attachment style, my dad had been in the Navy, so he was come and back and gone and whatever, and there was a lot of inconsistency. But when people met me in my 20s, I would say, oh, I came from a Leave It to Beaver family. My parents stayed married until they died. Everything was great. I was in denial. And so what I did is the other common thing. I unconsciously attracted untrustworthy partners to confirm my unconscious belief that people can't be trusted, right? So in the end, we become someone often who either trusts too easily or ignores the red flags on love's race course. Now, what do you do about it? Well, first of all, here's how you know if you're somebody who trusts too easily. One, you thrive in closeness. You really, 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 really badly want to get close to someone fast and you want to trust them. So you want to ignore some of the red flags. Or number two, you're doing so good at the ignoring that you usually think your partners are pretty perfect at the beginning. You tend to idealize either authority figures or romantic partners. Number three, are you one of those who can't stay single for very long? Mm-hmm, that's you. That's a sign of dependency. You need a relationship, any relationship. So as a result, you move too close, too fast, you ignore red flags, and you end up trusting too easily, and then you get hurt. When we come back, I'm going to tell you three ways how you can fix this. You are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. We're live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. AM 640, you have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. Okay, I'm talking to you. If you are somebody who falls in love too fast and trusts too easily, and then everything explodes, here's what I need you to do. You need to learn to move slower in your relationships. You're not going to like this prescription, but here it goes. Wait 3 months before having sex. If this is your issue, don't get your brain clouded with the neurohormones of sexuality. You have got to slow things down and let your prefrontal cortex, yeah, the thinking part of your brain, make assessments and decisions about somebody. Secondly, you need to depend on your friends' opinions. Now, for many people, I would say don't listen to your friends. If your heart tells you, if your stomach tells you this is the person for you, but not you, okay? You have a bad picker. You have an anxious attachment style. You will go right back to the scene of the crime and be hurt again. So early in a relationship, make sure you introduce your friends to the people you're dating and ask them what they think of this new partner. Oh, and listen to what they say. So when I was, you know, it was many stages of growth and healing when I got over my own anxious attachment style. And I always would be attracted to these avoidant guys. And then I would think like, well, he's not as physically attractive or rich as the last one, so he must not be avoidant somehow. I'd be like, and I remember having a friend over for dinner, and I invited a guy I had been dating for only like a few weeks, actually. And she called me afterward, and she's like, okay, you need to dump him right away. And I'm like, why? And she goes, all I saw was the back of his head. He had his head turned. He stared at you the whole time. Didn't even bring me into the conversation. Didn't even care that I was there or whatever. And I was like, oh, you're right. He was acting so avoidant with you. And that's my problem. I get attracted to those avoidant people. Avoidant people, by the way, do know how to obtain sex. They learn how to say exactly what you need to get that kind of intimacy, but the emotional intimacy they have a hard time with. And the third thing you need to do is look for flaws, not perfections, because you over-report the positive things on new people you meet. And I used to be that way. I remember. And you have to ask yourself, you look for the flaws and then say, well, could I live with those flaws? Instead of only blowing up what you think are the good things about somebody. Okay, I want to change the topic just a little bit. Speaking of trust, I got trust on my mind a lot today. I don't know why. I'm going to have to analyze that. I'll bring it up in my own therapy, okay? By the way, later in the show, I want to talk about when it's time to break up with your therapist. If my therapist is listening, I'm not breaking up with you. I just had this idea for a segment, okay? We can analyze why I got that idea, but it has nothing to do with you and me, okay? We're not breaking up. But there are a few things that might want to tweak you a little bit. Okay, so while I'm on the subject of trust, you know, trust is a very, very sacred thing in a relationship. And sometimes it is not your issue. It's not that you just are untrustworthy or cause explosions or whatever. It's because something real happened. And trust has been broken in a relationship. Maybe you found out your partner was lying. Maybe your partner cheated on you. Maybe they were financially unfaithful in some way. But when trust has been broken, making repair is very important that you do it carefully and in a number of steps. I want to remind you that intimacy, emotional intimacy, is built during the repair process. You know, love is a rocky road with lots of ruptures followed by repairs. And it is when we come back into a relationship after an issue that we build the greatest intimacy. So I'm going to assume that you were the one that messed up, okay? I don't know. Did you cheat on him? Did you steal from her? What happened? Whatever you did. You can still salvage this, and let me explain how. First, you need to really, really, really learn how to listen. Stop talking about all the reasons why you did that bad thing, trying to rationalize your behavior. Stop and learn to tolerate the anger and hurt feelings that your partner is expressing. You know, so much can be dissipated if we can just listen to each other and acknowledge their feelings. Don't get into an arguing of the facts conversation. The facts don't matter. The fact is, they're feeling hurt. And it's your job to allow them to vent. And yeah, you're going to sit there and you're going to take it. And you're not going to be thinking up comebacks and defenses. You're just going to look sad and empathetic. Make that V with your eyebrows. Okay. And you're going to empathize with them. You're going to acknowledge what they're saying by saying words like, I hear you. I understand. But the next step is the most important. You need to ask them clearly what would make them happy. What is needed to make this repair happen? What is needed to prevent a recurrence? They might say, you know what? I need your passwords to all your social media. And if you've cheated on somebody, I think that's a perfectly logical request. Give it to them. If you really want to prove that you're trustworthy, then you need to open up and be trustworthy. Kayla's rolling her eyes. She's, look, if you cheated on somebody, Kayla, and they said, okay, if you really want to get back in this relationship and save things, can I have your password to Instagram? What would you say?
No.
Then you don't want this relationship.
I guess not. I just feel like that's an invasion of privacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you invaded somebody else's bed, that was an invasion of privacy. She didn't really cheat on anybody. This is a joke. We're making this up. Hypothetical. What you have to do is take full responsibility for your actions. Don't sidestep the issue. Don't try to shift blame to the, oh, well, you know, if you had sex with me more often, then I wouldn't have to cheat. Stop it. You own your body. You're in control. There are things you can discuss in the relationship without having to do that. Also, use the biggest and most important two words that you can ever use in a relationship. I'm sorry. And say them authentically. And say them over. Express true, authentic regret and continue to have open and honest communication. I want you to know, if this has been a serious betrayal, like cheating or something, I think you really need to make the conversation a little wider to talk about your relationship as a whole and how the two of you can rebuild together. I want to remind you, an affair is a symptom of a problem. It's never the actual problem. It's a reaction to a relationship problem that already existed. All right, when we come back, I have a very special guest, one of the country's biggest and most famous and most successful dating coaches, Evan Mark Katz. And the reason why I wanted to have Evan Katz on is because he's a man. And my favorite conversation, and I love to pick his brain, is on male psychology. Ladies, if you aren't listening, well, then you're not knowing I'm going to say this. Okay, tell your girlfriends to log on and listen. Turn up the volume. You're going to need to listen to Evan Katz when we come back. You're listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. We're live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.
Help me, please, doctor. I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart.
KFI AM 640, you have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show, and I invited on the show today an old colleague of mine. Can I call you a colleague? Can I call you a friend, Evan Katz? How are you?
You can call me whatever you want. You have me on your show, and I really appreciate it.
I want you to know that Evan Katz is a dating coach, and while I normally get a little like what kind of education does a dating coach have? What do they know about psychology? I also am very cognizant that a lot of people do great work learning on their own, but also have huge gut instincts. And Evan has proven that his gut instinct is, you know, spot on because he's been responsible for so many marriages. And so, Evan, welcome to the show. Evan Katz specializes in, is it correct to say, successful women who kind of don't know how to turn off their competitive nature on dates. Is that correct?
That's a small piece of the puzzle. But yeah, I help smart, strong, successful women who have everything but the guy make better long-term relationship choices.
And one of the ways you do that is you help them, educate them about male psychology. And I'll say, even myself, years ago when I was single, I used to think that men thought like women. What is the biggest misconception that women have about how men think?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you're opening a huge can of worms there. But
I know, and we only have 8 minutes.
It's always really fraught because we could always say men do this, women do this, and we could always talk about, you know, the how a population that, you know, is not monolithic. In general, I think women tend to be surprised at something that my wife pointed out to me that I thought was ingenious and quotable, that men look for sex and find love. In the process of looking for sex, they discover, oh, I actually like you and I could see myself with you. But it starts with the sexual impulse and later turns into something more platonic where it doesn't always work the same in reverse. So women are perpetually surprised, frustrated, and disappointed that men could so easily separate sex and love.
Right. And actually, there's tons of research to support this, that even though men are looking for sex, in order to fall in love, they need norepinephrine and vasopressin. And those neurohormones actually take some time to develop. So they don't fall in love through sex, even though they're looking for that. It's not like, I think a lot of women think, well, I'm going to convert a hookup into a relationship.
Attraction is what gets someone in the door. Without attraction, the whole thing's a non-starter. But I don't know any happily married man who stayed with his wife because of the sex. It's really more about a feeling that you have when you're with someone, a feeling of being accepted, feeling at home. And these are not the kind of things that you could tell from a dating app. These are not the things you could kind of tell from a first date, which is why dating is such a challenge for so many people.
And I think that women, tell me if I'm correct here, I think they underestimate, I mean, I guess we grow up in patriarchy. We think of, you know, all these men as being in charge and running the world. But I think women underestimate how much men are still little boys and want to just feel appreciated and loved.
I think, yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. So we could talk about patriarchy, and certainly not as a white guy, the first thing I'm going to lead with when I'm talking about men. Mm-hmm. But we could talk about the validity of that. And at the same time, in my world, you know, I have a course called Love You. I tell women that they're the CEOs and men are the interns applying for a job. And if you don't like how the intern is performing, he doesn't get the job. He doesn't have power over you. If anything, you have power over him.
Oh, my gosh. How often do I tell women this? They're quite surprised to learn that they control the pace of the sexual relationship and they control everything at the beginning. In fact, I teach at Cal State Channel Islands, and when I go through some evolutionary psychology and human mating strategy, when I say that line that women control everything, all the men unconsciously just nod in class. But women do not know that they have the power. Why are they so focused on fear of losing him early on?
There's a saying in my course. I say he's not the last man on earth, but I think we always come from this place of fear and scarcity that this is it, we can't do better. So there's this process of inertia that if you fall in love with someone, that somehow you have to justify all their bad behavior and bend over backwards and contort yourself to maintain a relationship, because being single and alone is worse, and it's not. If anything, what we try to do is raise the bar for what you should come to expect from men, and better to be single and open to a new relationship than to be miserable in a relationship. So I basically let women know, if you value yourself enough to have a 90th percentile relationship, you can. And if you settle into a relationship just because he was nice to you for 3 months and he's cute and he makes money, it's ultimately that's up to you to take the power of the CEO instead of perpetually acting like the needy intern who needs the job, because you don't.
You know what's funny is that, you know, in recent years, I've started to not only preach my advice, but take my own advice. And I have a wonderful boyfriend now with a secure attachment. And guess what his nickname is for me? It is CEO. He calls me CEO all the time because I was very clear about my boundaries and what I wanted. And you know, the thing is, so many women, the giving part they have down, right? You don't need to work on learning how to care for a man and learning how to cook and learning how to send cute notes or, you know, get yourself all beautiful for him, all that. Women mostly do that naturally. It's more about learning to have the boundaries and go, you know what? That doesn't work for me. How do you convince women to have better boundaries?
It doesn't require much convincing, because everybody who turns to me as a dating and relationship coach knows that whatever she's doing, you know, isn't working. It hasn't made her happy, whatever her pattern subconsciously has been for 50 years. So everybody's already bought into the idea that they have to do something different. If anything, the concept of coaching is very much like the concept of getting healthy or losing weight. There's not anybody in the world who doesn't know how to do it. It's not the knowledge that's the problem. It's having the consistent application that makes it hard. So that's why I'm like, you know, Love You is my gym, and I'm like the personal trainer. I sort of hold people's hand because we tend to lapse into patterns. We say things like, I attract the wrong men. I attract toxic narcissists. no, you're not a magnet. You don't attract toxic narcissists. You choose them.
You choose them.
You choose over and over and over, and you let them get away with being toxic narcissists where you don't feel safe, heard, and understood. But it's not the toxic narcissist's fault for being a toxic narcissist. Other women will have the boundary and cut them off after two dates. So it's just learning to have a quicker trigger figure and, using these catchphrases, slow to hire, quick to fire.
Yeah.
You don't want to hop into bed with a stranger and call him your boyfriend. You don't want to marry some guy that you've known for a short period of time. You really want someone to prove themselves to be up to the task of being your husband and constantly evaluate whether you're happy in the relationship instead of operating from that place that I got to lock this in because this guy's such a catch.
Evan Mark Katz, you know the problem with radio. It's much too short and we have to go. Before we go, though, how long do you think a woman should wait before she has sex with a man for the first time?
It's a term I call sexclusivity. I think if you could handle having sex without a commitment, God bless you. A lot of people complain that it doesn't really result in a relationship. So I tell my clients it's not a number of dates. It's not a number of weeks or months. Wait until you're in a committed boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. And for some people, that's 4 weeks, and some people, that's 8 weeks. But once you know that the next day he's definitely going to call you, you should feel safe enough to take that plunge.
And you echo what I say. I say, when you know you have trust, then it's time. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. I know you got to run to your fantasy football. If you want to find Evan Katz, he's at evanmarkkatz.com. Thank you so much for being here. All right, when we come back, I'm going to give you some actual how-to tips, how to grow intimacy. Whether you have an anxious attachment style or an avoidant attachment style, I'm going to tell you how you can create closeness. You're listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. We're live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.